This case is U.S. v. Curley and John Jackson.
May it please the Court, John Romano for the United States of America.
Mr. Romano, you either are so a worthy advocate that you got brass here watching you, or you're just not trusted. Maybe it's both.
You'll have to ask.
Okay, I will, I will. Which is it, Mr. Fisher?
I just feel very strongly about the case.
Okay, unlike most cases.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you. The sentencing proceeding in this case went seriously off track. The district court committed 3 significant legal errors before imposing unreasonably low sentences on parents who...
Well, whether it's unreasonably low, doesn't that depend on whether or not the guidelines, whether or not there's an analogous guideline under the ACA?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean,
you
think
under, even under 3553, you think it's unreasonable?
I do, Your Honor. I mean, what happened here was very serious conduct, essentially heinous offenses. Children the ages between 2 months and 4 years old, beaten.
Well, you're now venturing into territory. There's some dispute about what happened here. There was a jury verdict, clearly. The government, were you the trial counsel in the case?
I was not, Your Honor.
Okay. Were you the one who furnished the pre-sentence report to the probation officer?
I was not, Your Honor.
Okay. So you're basically falling on the sword here.
There's nothing to fall on, Your Honor. I think we're very proud of this case. And
but the district court, after a 10-hour sentencing hearing, the longest sentencing hearing I think I've ever heard tell of, one of the longest, was convinced that she could not put any faith in the pre-sentence report. Struck exceptions of the pre-sentence report for that reason, because it was produced by the prosecutor rather than an independent investigation being done. So that puts us in a quandary where you're making arguments about what happened, what the conduct was, and based upon that conduct, the sentence was unreasonable. But how can we know better than the trial judge who was there what the conduct was?
Well, and I have to, first I want to address the pre-sentence report issue. The government did not write the pre-sentence report. As in all cases in the district,
the
government provided a statement of facts. The probation department...
I thought there was representation where the government conceded that it wrote the factual portion. Is that not right?
The government provided a statement of the facts. The probation department on its own decides what it wants to do. The government didn't sit there and make the probation department adopt the government statement. So that's the first thing. Secondly, everyone, once the draft PSR is produced, everyone has the ability to object to it. That's exactly what happened here. So I just want to address that first. Secondly, we had a 39-day trial. The government submitted the entire trial testimony to this court.
The court said that the government submitted the statement of facts. I don't know what else in terms of an analysis that was incorporated in the PSR. And I thought the prosecutor admitted that they did invite, I'm sorry, I'm quoting from the defense counsel who made the argument at sentencing, that the government submitted the statement of facts. They submitted the memo which had within a statement of facts and that was incorporated.
The probation department decides whatever it's going to do. The government has no power over what the probation department does. Yes, we submitted a statement of facts.
Okay.
The probation department decided to adopt that because, again, this is a 39-day trial. They couldn't be there the whole time.
Right.
But again, I think that's neither here nor there to the issues in this case, which are whether there was a sufficiently analogous guideline, whether the court simply refused to find aggravating facts at sentencing.
Okay, let's start because that the second part of that is related to the first part of that because if there's no analogous guideline, then whether or not that changes what the court has to do in terms of a factual inquiry.
To a certain extent, Your Honor, but not completely. First of all,
well, the trial judge did say there was no analogous guideline.
Yes,
your position is entirely the opposite.
Well, we think that's wrong. Yes, so that's a legal issue.
Why is it wrong?
Because, Your Honor, what this court looks at, first of all, 2X5.1 says is that finding a sufficiently analogous guideline should essentially be the rule, not the exception. And what the guidelines say is that. The guidelines that have
been... But that doesn't mean they should find the analogous guideline if there is no analogous guideline.
Of course. But what the guidelines say is that the guidelines that have been promulgated cover the type of criminal behavior that most such offenses, that being assimilative crimes, prescribe. This isn't some bizarre offense. This is a child abuse offense.
There is a case, isn't there, that pretty much lays out what the district judge is supposed to do in these circumstances?
Cavoni does that, doesn't it?
I think so, Your Honor.
Cavoni does exactly that. And the facts here are not in dispute, so the question is whether there, as a question of law, whether there is a sufficiently analogous guideline.
Yeah, and I think what Boney says is you look at the, and what the guidelines say, 1B1.2 says, is you look at the offense conduct charged in the counts of conviction. Here, that is not in dispute. In fact, the parties and the court agreed to put that directly in the verdict sheet. If you look at
the no circuit has ever rejected the Osborne-Elvis-based inquiry to that.
Your Honor, the law is a little bit of a mess in the area. I mean, I think if you look in the
Ninth Circuit. The answer to that question is, has any circuit rejected the Osborne test?
The courts haven't really addressed it exactly. I mean, I don't. The Fourth Circuit hasn't. This court adopted Osborne as far as the standard of
review. We adopted Osborne.
As far as the standards of review. This court didn't say apply elements, compare elements. It never got to that because Osborne was a second step case where we were comparing to see which guideline was most analogous. It wasn't a sufficiently analogous case.
There was an Elvis case that Cothran, what is it?
Cothran.
Yeah.
Cothran doesn't say that because it doesn't need to get there. But look, I think either way, I think if you go straight on 1B1.2 and look at the offense conduct, we're there. Everyone agreed what the offense conduct was as to counts 3, 6, 12. The verdict sheet says physically assaulting with various objects and with their hands. When the jury was asked that question, they repeatedly said guilty. There's no doubt about that. That is within the ballpark of the assault guidelines. I mean, it is assault. The other counts, forcing toddlers to ingest hot sauce. Again, that's what the verdict sheet, that's what they found guilty of.
Do you look at the facts, or do you say you don't look at the elements? You look at the actual predicate.
I think you could do both. But what 1B1.2 says and what Bode says is look at the offense conduct charged in the count of conviction. Yeah. Again, we're not talking about random allegations here. We're talking about this is the means of committing these elements. So much so that it was put direct in the verdict sheet. This is what the jury said. They physically assaulted them with their hands. That is how they endangered these children.
Okay, looking at those elements, how can we then say that the assault guideline sufficiently is analogous to the state offense, which has been assimilated into our law?
Your Honor,
put the fat in the fire, exactly. That's where the question lies.
Well, if you use the elements approach, and again, there's nothing except for, Osborne kind of said this, you compare elements. But even if you do that, what I would ask you to look at is look at the Allard case. The Eighth Circuit decided the same exact day as Osborne, applying the elements. They said that manslaughter was sufficiently analogous to vehicular battery. Nobody died in that case. The point is, when you compare elements, you're not looking for a match. There can be no match. If we found an offense that matched child endangerment, then it would have been improper to assimilate this under the ACCA. So you're not looking for a match. You're looking for something within the ballpark.
That's a good argument. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but I thought the defendants wanted to ask the jury to make specific findings as to the harm done, and the government opposed that. Am I right about that?
So what happened was there was some dispute about the statute, which is a little convoluted, and the defendants wanted to be charged as an element that the jury had found a substantial amount of harm. That is not an element of these offenses. So the government rightly said, no, that should not be charged as an element, but if you like, we'll put it as a special interrogatory. The defendants rejected that proposal. They wanted it to be a lesser-included offense. It's not. New Jersey law is very clear on this. It's not a lesser-included offense.
You said before that there was an explicit finding by the jury of an assault?
Well, Your Honor, the specific offense conduct, the way of committing this offense as to counts 3, 6, and 12, was physically assaulting with objects and with their hands. That is what the verdict sheet says.
See, the problem with that, and that's why I have trouble assuming it's an automatic layover with endangered welfare of children. Take spanking with a belt strap. You can clearly look at just a belt used to spank a kid as being an assault that fits squarely within the assault statute. But clearly, the endangering the welfare of a child is focused on something very, very different. It recognizes parents' bashi, it recognizes the parents' right exercise discipline over their children, and to just look at that as an assault, spanking would be a flat-out assault, but it would not necessarily be endangering the welfare of a child.
But again, Your Honor, we're looking at a conviction here. This isn't, the jury was charged that you can exercise corporal punishment. The jury was charged a very strong good faith instruction, whether they were doing this in an honest mistake or whether this was all in the best interest of the child.
But the issue is the fit with assault, aggravated assault, or assault and battery, not aggravated assault, and endangering the welfare of the child in New Jersey law. The issue is the fit of those two things.
Well, it's, again, within the ballpark. Judge Gorsuch said, and Judge Gorsuch in the Tenth Circuit in Riggs said, it's within the ballpark. That's all we're looking for, within the ballpark. Because, again, we're not looking for a match. We're just looking for something that's going to help the judge.
Okay. If we agree with you that the judge improperly did not use the right guideline and did not properly use the Assimilated Crimes Act the way it should have, do we just remand it back to the district court for resentencing, or is it inappropriate for us to go forward and say, based on the facts here and the jury verdict, that there was substantive due process violations as well in the evaluation by the district court in its opinion.
Well, Your Honor, we think that would be very helpful. I mean, this is a case, again, it was a time.
Well, we could do it very simply, just remand it back and I don't know, maybe see you again in another, visit the court again in another 8 months. Yeah, I don't know, you're working on straight salary or
This would be great. Look, Your Honor, there's four errors here. Any of them, I think, can justify reversing
it. Is that your request for the case to go back to Judge Hayden for sentence?
Your Honor, we haven't made it, you know, sometimes we ask for reassignment. That's not, you know, something we did here.
We're not asking for that here.
We haven't asked for it. We think, you know, Judge Hayden is a very, you know, very capable judge. We think if this court gives the proper direction, that we will hopefully arrive at.
Well, suppose we don't agree with the substantive findings of the court. Is that premature for us to delve into that for guidance or whatever you want to call
it? It's not, Your Honor. I mean, this court has done it before, and both Goff and Leitchock had found procedural errors and then also said the sentence is just too low. And that would be very helpful here because, again, these sentences are so low that really the district court needs to be told, look, given what happened here, probation in 24 months are just can't be right.
Well, we might think, if we may or may not, I don't know, conclude that these sentences are too low, but we may think that your sentence suggestions are off the wall as well.
That's fine, Your Honor. I mean, again, this will go back to the district court. It could be argued. It could be the judge could arrive at a sentence, and it might not be a sentence we like, but it might be a sentence we live with, or maybe it's a sentence that we agree with, and the defendants will appeal. But again, the question we're at here is, are probation in 24 months something a reasonable sentencing court would impose?
Mr. Romano, give me the steps that you say Judge Hayden skipped that she should revisit.
Well, the first thing is whether there's a sufficiently analogous guideline. And again, we think that assault, whether there's a sufficiently analogous guideline is the first step.
All right. And we say that's the assault
guideline. It could be either assault or aggravated assault because, again, there's a cross-reference in the assault guideline that considers all the conduct.
And that would require further fact-finding.
It would, Your Honor. At that point, we think the aggravated assault guideline would probably apply. But again, that's for the court to decide, the district court to decide. But first, sufficiently analogous guideline. Second, the court needs to make fact findings. The court said over and over again, oh, it's not the province of the court. I can only rely on exactly what the jury found in the verdict sheet. That's not how sentencing works. We don't look at the elements only and say, now I'm done. We only know that the jury found X. You have to make findings of fact. And, you know, that includes not just at the guideline step, but also at the 3553A step. We're looking at the nature and circumstances of this offense. The court basically said, oh, well, I'm not going to make any findings. I don't know what happened here because the jury
didn't. Well, she got that exaggeration. She didn't say. She said after the trial it was longer than a month. It was a 39-day trial.
It was.
So she clearly knew what the jury thought happened in terms of the elements of defense. I thought the problem was when you got beyond that into trying to apply the guidelines, that's where the problem arose.
Well, Your Honor, again, we submitted the entire trial record. My brief is filled with citations to the record. I'd really urge this court just to take a look at some of those citations.
Could she apply the guidelines and come out with the same sentence?
Not if this court tells her it's too low. I mean,
I think that's not the question you're being asked.
Well, I think it would be very difficult because, again, the guidelines will be pretty long. I mean, they will be. Maybe they're too long, maybe they're not. We ask for sentences below those guidelines. So, you know, but you can't say that the sentence was harmless. I mean, again, this would have been a 15-plus-year variance that wasn't stated, wasn't explained. The work wasn't done just to explain such a large variance.
And this is totally going down a different road. Maybe I should wait for your rebuttal time. But I was troubled by the argument that you took a different, you're not you, Mr. Romano, or your office. Well, your office, writ large, took a position in U.S. versus Lofton that was totally an opposite to it, and actually started to have a note sent asking whether or not judicial estoppel should apply here. But what do we do with that? And I looked at pages 30 to 35 of the brief that was submitted in Lofton in Texas, and it clearly is a very different position than you're taking, the exact opposite position, because there that position matches up. What do we do with that?
Well, I don't think that that's fair, Your Honor, because in Lofton...
Which part of this is fair?
That it ratcheted up the sentence. In Lofton, all you had was a defendant saying, oh, assault guidelines should apply at 0 to 6 months. The government disputed that. In fact, if you look at what happened in Lofton, the aggravated assault guideline probably would have applied there. So the guidelines analysis was not done. So I don't know that 48 months was over what the aggravated assault guideline would have supplied. So that's first. Secondly, the fact that a U.S. attorney's office in a different district took a different view of a different statute really has nothing to do with us here.
Well, you made a point on page 2 of your brief of telling us that the Solicitor General personally approved the appeal.
So this appeal.
This appeal.
This appeal. Yeah, and as you know, in defensive appeals, U.S. Attorney's offices file briefs that don't get reviewed by the Solicitor General. We think that their view in that case was wrong. If you look, they simply matched elements and said, oh, these have different elements. There's no analogous guideline. That's not how you do the analysis.
Well, you're not bad that you did, that the U.S. Attorney, the other district, did 180-degree different.
No.
You're not just bound by it in this district.
We're not. Again, what we would point out is that the Solicitor General personally approved this appeal, personally approved the position we're taking in this appeal.
I was wondering why you troubled yourselves and us by letting us know that the Solicitor General personally appealed. This is one little sentence. It's buried at the end of a sentence at the bottom of the page, but I wonder why that was relevant. It seemed like it was
I think that's actually a hook in the statute, Your Honor, that the Solicitor General personally approved sentencing appeals, and that's why
it's in the brief. I've seen that in the brief before. Maybe just overlooked it.
Do Your Honor have any other questions, or can I be heard on the button?
I have a note here. Is it accurate that the conduct involved in this case resulted in fractures? Is that?
That's what the experts say, and that's what
who's expert?
We had two experts. The government had two experts.
That was debated.
Your Honor, a lot of what the defendants say was debated, I think.
Well, the extent of it, and that's, I think, part of the problem, that it was harm, and there was some doubt about origins of the harm. There was one expert who said that one of the fractures was too old and it may well have been inflicted prior to the time these defendants took custody, and the person who had custody at that point was a recognized child abuser. Those were the kinds of things I thought that troubled Judge Hayden. That was when she had problems with the facts.
Now, there were certain things that came out of trial, and again, these things were all disputed. You know, this was litigated at trial, 39-day trial. Some of these things have nothing really to do with the substantive offenses. So some of Joshua's injuries are part of the conspiracy, but are not part of substantive offenses. The government thinks they proved that at least by a preponderance. I mean, there's an issue with the bile duct fracture, and there's an issue with some fractures. Again, even if you put in at sentencing, the government said literally, you could put those things aside. Don't even worry about those. If you don't want to deal with them, don't. Look at just what we know happened here. Look at what's not
the expert testimony here. Really wasn't objected to or was it questioned by the defendant, was it?
Well, they certainly didn't put on their own expert. I mean,
there was no expert on the part that said your expert was off the wall on it.
No, and some of the stuff that they're raising in their brief was, I think, you know, very quickly rebutted by those actual witnesses. I'll give you an example. They say Dr. Corey testified that C, I'll refer to her as C, received, you know, too much milk because, you know, Carolyn was mixing the milk with the formula, and this increased, you know, her sodium level a certain amount. Well, Dr. Corey testified on cross and then on redirect that even if C got more sodium that way, it had no effect whatsoever on her astounding sodium levels. So, you know, they put that in the brief and say, oh, there's this dispute and there's a question. That's not true at all. The witness is very clear on that. And I would also point out, if the jury believed that, then they would have been acquitted of those counts. If, you know, mixing milk...
What would be your submission? Because that troubled me. What is your submission in terms of the cause of the sodium levels based upon the jury's verdict? What got the sodium levels elevated?
They were forcing her to ingest hot sauce, which has a lot of sodium, and not giving her any water. And what the witnesses said was this would take days for her to get to that level. And again, I mean, they said she arrived at the hospital at death's door, more of them, floppy. If you look at the pictures were taken 3 or 4 days later, and she still looks awful. And they're saying when she came in, she was that much worse. And again, this happened before, so this isn't even the first time this happened. It's the second time. I would just say, look, the conduct here is so awful that these sentences are too low. And again, if you have questions, I would ask you just to look at the government's brief has copious citations to the record. This was not, in all due respect, a close case on liability, because what happened here was really beyond the pale. And again, I would also ask you to look at the growth charts in this case, which weren't even disputed. And, you know, Your Honor's talking about, you know, the judge had issues at sentencing. The judge didn't talk about any of this. Look at the sentencing. See if you see anything about the child starving. Starving. And in summation, the defendants can't even really respond to that. Look at the growth chart. It goes like this. Says nothing about it. Look at the sentencing transcript. See if the judge says anything about the defendants lying to all the doctors. That doesn't come up either. And what the judge does say is, this wasn't serious. This didn't really harm society. You know, the United States begs to differ on that point.
Your Honor, thank you very much.
Morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
Herbert Waldman, Javel Van Borgaff for Carolyn Jackson. Before I begin my argument, I'd like to correct a few things that Mr. Romano said in response to court's questions. First, Were there defense experts that disputed those of the government? Absolutely there were. Matter of fact, they were the treating doctors that we brought in from Oklahoma who disputed the government's experts as to what the cause of various conditions were, particularly of Joshua. Was there evidence, Ms. Romano said, the sodium level was so high because of hot sauce? Not so. The doctor, Dr. Corey, said he didn't know what the sodium content of hot sauce was. So that's what he said,
and you have a government's expert saying what the sodium content is. Isn't that, and we have a jury's verdict, why would we have grounds to question their supposition as to the cause for the elevated sodium levels? Well, if you have a defense expert saying, I don't know what could have caused it, and a government expert saying, I'll tell you what caused it. It's the high levels of, in hot sauce.
Well, but he didn't say that. That's what I'm saying.
The government's expert didn't say that.
Dr. Corey didn't say that.
Yeah, but it's obvious that's what the implications.
I don't think so. Not from the medical records. Not at all.
Wasn't the testimony that there are high sodium levels in hot sauce?
No. There isn't. We explore that in trial.
Mr. Romano is making this up?
He's incorrect.
Well, what gave us such a high salt sodium reading?
What caused it?
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what I say. It's not in the record, but I can. The girl had a hyponatremic episode in Indiana. She had a condition known as granular casts, which Dr. Corey never picked up. Her kidney was not functioning well when she returned to New Jersey. They never had a test to see if it was cleared up. And
if none of that's in the record, the jury's not going to know that, Margaret, and they just rely on the government's expert.
I'm sorry.
If none of that is in the record, the jury's not going to know about it.
No, that is in the record, that she did have this condition in Indiana, that Dr. Corey never realized until he was cross-examined about this condition of granular casts, and that it was in the record that no tests were ever conducted to see whether she was better.
You disagree that the sodium levels were extraordinarily high and abnormal.
Absolutely.
And that the child's growth rate was also abnormal.
Absolutely. But there's nothing in the record that really answers the question that was asked to Mr. Romano, why were they so high? And that there are alternate explanations for why they're so high.
Like what? Like that would make sense as to the growth rate and the sodium level and the other physical attributes of being mishandled?
I have no quarrel with the growth rates. I have no quarrel with saying, we said at trial, Carol Jackson was not a good mother. She had her own ideas of nutrition. She had her own ideas about child rearing, and they were wrong. But if you want to get into the weeds of it, and did what she did cause sodium levels, it may have because if she added the milk instead of water to the formula.
What about constant striking of the child causing fractures, physical assaults, and beating a natural child with a belt? Why isn't that assaultive behavior, regardless of a parenting purpose?
First of all, we dispute, and the records dispute is in dispute, as to causes of fracture. One of the fractures that they claim to see, the jury found the defendants not guilty of not getting proper medical attention because of what was mentioned before. But
the jury did make a specific finding, I hear this morning, that there was a physical assault on the child, children.
There was no question that corporal punishment was used. That was clear from the start. What's not clear, and what the jury verdict didn't determine, is did these really serious injuries, these really serious conditions that the children have, were they caused by the defendants?
Why wouldn't the jury's verdict determine that?
Because they didn't have to. We had asked the jury.
But if they found the defendants guilty, doesn't that say that they were caused by the defendants?
No. Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
The jury found them guilty, but the injuries might have been caused by some other factor?
Absolutely. That's what our witness from Oklahoma, Dr. Manter, the best example is the bile duct. They claim that it was caused by hitting the child with a blunt object in the abdomen. The defendants admitted from the start they used corporal punishment on the child, but they said they didn't cause that injury. We brought in the surgeon who repaired the injury, and he disputed the government's expert.
Yeah, but you can't get over the jury verdict, which found them guilty. And if they're found guilty, you've got to conclude that their conduct was beyond corporal punishment, which is administered by parents and even allowed under state law.
Under the jury charge, the jury found, could have found, and that's just the problem, we don't know.
Well, the jury found them guilty. That means that they did not do, the result of these physical injuries was not within the accepted parents patriae.
No,
accepted.
I don't think that's true at all.
If they didn't, the jury would have found not guilty.
No, I can tell you why that's not so. The jury charge said, if you inflict unreasonable corporal punishment, what's unreasonable? Testimony from the government's case is, for example, Joshua, the first adopted child, he would get spanked when he didn't get into his car seat quickly enough. Jury could have very well found that's unreasonable. Doesn't mean that they found that he caused a bile duct fracture when the doctor who treated him for it said it couldn't have happened the way the government claims. And as Judge McKee points out in Olowski, you give great deference to the treating physician. The treating physicians, and Judge Hayden emphasized this, said we have to recognize the fact that the treating physicians who saw these children at the time and treated them for these conditions didn't think that there was abuse. So the heart of the problem is that the jury, we, and Mr. Romano was wrong in this as well, we were the ones who asked for special interrogatories that weren't given. The government didn't ask for special interrogatories. They argued against special interrogatories. They wanted a bifurcated procedure. They wanted the jury to come back later and find, did they create substantial harm?
New Jersey's child endangerment statute can involve a whole range of conduct. It can be incessant scolding of a child, and it could, on the other end of the spectrum, involve very serious injury to the child.
Absolutely.
It is at the other end of the spectrum, I think, that the government is arguing here that was given to the jury, and they made a jury finding. Why doesn't, in those circumstances, the assault sentencing provision apply?
Yeah, because incessant scolding wouldn't get to the level of assault.
Yeah, this is, we claim that this was on one end of the spectrum, where there was corporal punishment, and it may have been excessive, but it didn't create the serious injuries.
Take me as a hypothetical. There is serious injury to a child under the endangerment statute. In that circumstance, very serious injury, why doesn't the assault sentencing provision apply?
Well,
why wouldn't it? Let's say because we're speaking of a hypothetical.
Okay, I mean, if the question is that analogous to, if that's the question, Your Honor, I don't think it's analogous, and my co-counsel will discuss, and there's been some discussion before about the elements. I think Judge Hayden made a very interesting and profound observation that this statute and the assault statute are just completely different animals. That was her parens patriae analysis. And the analysis is that normally one person can't strike another person. But in the case of parents disciplining their children, they can. It's a totally
you can strike a child, but you can't do it within the parents patriae provision. And you are arguing that the jury verdict here did not find cruelty or neglect. That's what you're actually saying. That it was not a finding of cruelty or neglect.
No,
I'm having a little trouble with saying that this verdict does not do exactly that, saying that whatever parental guidance was given to these children was beyond that which was necessary and was actually neglect or cruelty, which is very similar to assault.
Now, I don't disagree that they found cruelty or neglect. That's what they were charged. What I'm saying is that they didn't find that these serious injuries were caused by the parents, and that's a very different story.
But they did find cruelty or neglect by the verdict.
They did. That's what they were charged. They weren't charged on assault, and they certainly weren't charged if they had to find the cause of these injuries.
You're saying they weren't charged on assault?
They were not charged on assault.
What were they convicted of?
Cruelty and neglect.
What were they convicted of, and how was that defined?
The court read a sort of generic jury charge for each of the counts, which described the elements of cruelty and neglect. And they were never, the only way that assault entered into it is that some of the counts said they made them a
definition of cruelty under the New Jersey statute.
For those counts, the jury was never charged either what assault means, or more importantly, that they had to find that certain injuries were caused by the assault.
But then the verdict itself, don't they find that there's cruelty or neglect? And isn't cruelty and neglect not exactly the same, but within the guideline definition of assault or similar to assault?
No, because you could be, the jury charge has a lot of ways, Judge Hayden said, of vexing, harassing a child. Cruelty is a whole range of conduct that are completely different than assault.
Well, what is the difference if you are so cruel to someone? To have an assault, you don't actually have to have a hitting, a striking. You can assault someone without having a physical contact.
You can threaten them.
But you can threaten them, and you can deny them what they're entitled to and so forth. That's similar to assault, isn't it?
It is, but the difference between that and the child endangerment statute is that, and like I said in our brief, parents probably in every state and every day assault their children in the sense that they threaten them, and frankly, they probably strike them. The corporal punishment is widely employed more in some regions of the country than others, but that's not what the assault statute is getting at.
You don't suggest that the child endangerment statute does not embrace or include the conduct, assaultive conduct. You're not saying that, are you?
No.
It includes a lot of
other things as well. And just as an example, how would you apply the guideline? How do you look at, for a heartland analysis in assault, which is when the assault guideline itself never considered the parent-child relationship?
Easily, because in Allard, that where there was a manslaughter conviction, we determined that involuntary manslaughter was sufficient to a battery, even though for manslaughter someone's got to get killed. But we held it in Allard that it was sufficiently analogous to the battery guideline.
Well, in a manslaughter, you have to have a battery also, I assume.
Yeah,
child abuse aims, the statute aim at different things, societal problems.
The jury explicitly found that there was assaultive conduct in this case.
Well, it's hard to say for sure because they certainly weren't charged if they had to find assaultive conduct.
Now, I'm with this person in the auditorium. What exactly happened? What did you request? What did the government oppose?
It started in the discussion of the jury charge. Our proposed jury charge were structurally very different than the government's. Number one, we said that in order to find the defendant guilty of child endangerment, they have to show that substantial harm was either caused or threatened. We got that from the Model Penal Code, which the New Jersey statute was based on, and on case law. The government took the position that they had an option. They can either charge as we suggested, or under the same statute, they can charge. They don't have to use that statute that we relied on, which was incorporated into the criminal code, and they could charge so that the jury only has to find that the defendant did an act, and not that a substantial harm was caused. That's how it started.
Wait, that makes no sense. The defendant did an act?
Well, did an act of cruelty or neglect.
Okay, sorry, that's important.
Yeah. And so we said the act of cruelty or neglect has to cause a substantial harm. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if I have a fight with my teenage son and push him, that's an assault.
So first you have an act of cruelty and then you have a resulting harm, is that it?
You have to have a harm.
That's an assault.
Yeah, well, but we said that under the child endangerment statute, we're talking about a very serious crime the government's telling us, second degree crime. Pushing my teenage son is not what the statute intended. So then we lost that argument. We got to trial. We got to the portion where we were having submissions and jury charge again. And the government wanted to have a bifurcated format where the jury was charged, as they ultimately were, and then they would come back, and if they found the defendants guilty, they would then be asked, do you find that they caused substantial harm? We said what we would like is for the jury to get special interrogatories. And while they're deliberating guilt or innocence, they would also make a finding of whether there was substantial harm or not. Judge Hayden did neither. And that's how we ended up where we are. So as she said, we don't know what they found. Well, we certainly know that they found that they went over the line in terms of the use of corporal punishment, but we don't know if they found all these serious injuries.
Well, she attributed this, if I remember the opinion correctly, to mistake or bad parenting.
She thought that there was bad parenting in the sense that they were using corporal punishment at times where it was unnecessary.
Yeah, well, but how could you look at the conduct here, which was engaged in, and say that's bad parenting?
Well, it is bad parenting.
Or a mistake. What they did was intentional.
It was intentional.
Yeah, and you can't call this, bad parenting, that the injuries which were suffered by the kids is not usual bad parenting.
Well, you have to make the connection between the bad parenting and the injuries, and that's what she said she couldn't find.
Well.
And you're saying the jury's verdict does not
answer the question.
Well, yeah, but the jury's verdict, I resolved that they were guilty of these offenses.
Sure.
Of bad parenting and beyond bad parenting of assault, if you believe the guideline is analogous to the assault guideline is analogous to the conduct in this case.
If you do, but the jump that the government wants you to make is from assault to aggravated assault. And that was really
problem. That's a matter of fact finding, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
But the court did not do that.
The judge said she would not do that because in this case, and I think it's a very narrow situation, the government structured the trial and the charges so they didn't have to charge the statute, this is what they said, that included the substantial injury. They said, we can try this case without proving that the defendants caused a substantial injury. But then when it comes to sentencing, we can ask you, Judge Hayden, to make these findings of fact that they caused these injuries.
And I have a hard time accepting that that's what really happened.
I can assure you, Your Honor, that's just what happened.
I go back again.
And I find it incredible that also.
What is wrong with that if after the verdict comes in, the judge then must determine whether or not the conduct found by the jury is within one of the guidelines or is outside of the guidelines, and she relied basically on state law for sentencing here. She didn't rely on the guideline.
Well,
and if it's an assimilated crime, there's an analogous example, she has to go to one of the guidelines if it is analogous.
If there's an analogous guideline?
She found that assault was not analogous. To me, I don't know what would be more analogous under the guidelines than assault in this case. If you agree that the conduct of the parents was beyond bad parenting or mistake.
Well, in a sense, I agree if you say, I don't know what would be more analogous than assault. I can understand that. We disagree, and my co-counsel will talk about the element analysis. But what I do disagree with strongly is that aggravated assault is an analogous guideline because this is what we wanted the jury to determine, is whether these defendants caused those substantial bodily injury to the children. We claimed that the substantial injuries that were caused were not caused by the defendants, and we felt that we had a right to have the jury determine that, first as an element of the offense, but we lost that argument, but second as a matter of sentencing. And Judge Hayden, when we discussed the jury charge, Judge Hayden told the government, if I go with your analysis of the elements of the offense, there's going to be consequences when it comes to sentencing. You're going to have your finding of guilt, but you're not going to have your finding that they caused a substantial injury. And the government was satisfied with that until it came time for sentencing. And then they said, even though we took this determination away from the jury, you, Judge Hayden, can make those findings. You can find whether the defendants caused the bile duct perforation, you know, whether they caused...
After they sent the 28-J letter, is pointing us to the record as exactly where that interaction occurred, what you just said, where the judge said, okay, we'll do it that way, but there'll be consequences.
It's in my brief, Your Honor.
Okay, I missed it then. Yeah. The citation of the record is in
Yes, it is. And she said, you'll have your... I forget exactly how she phrased it, but she sort of told the government what they were getting themselves into, what position they had maneuvered themselves into, and they were satisfied. Then they wanted to come back and say, we want a judge to find all these serious injuries, and in a case where they structure the charges so that they can avoid a jury determination on exactly that issue, we don't feel that it's appropriate or proper constitutional to come back and say, let the judge make that determination. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is it's traditionally an element of the offense, the amount of injury, and did the defendant cause that injury? That's a traditional element of the offense. Jones versus the United States, you know, said that the degree of injury is a traditional element. You can't take that away from a jury by the way you structure your charge and then come back and try to sentence them.
Isn't it the case that elements of a crime increase the maximum statutory sentence but don't necessarily affect whether it's a serious assault or not?
Well, I think that there are different definitions, I guess, of the elements of an offense, but certainly using it is the amount of injury that an assault victim suffers and the defendant's responsibility for inflicting that injury is traditionally been considered an element of the offense.
But doesn't that affect whether it's a serious assault or not in the range that of the sentence that court imposes?
It does. Sure. The more serious the assault, the more serious the danger, the greater the extent of the injury to the victim in almost every jurisdiction.
But that analysis was not performed by the court in this case.
Pardon me?
That analysis was not performed by the court in this case.
It wasn't, because Judge Hayden said, don't ask me to determine whether the bile duct injury was caused, as example, yeah, by these defendants, when you didn't want the jury to determine it.
Yeah, before you were focusing on elements, and I'm wondering whether that's the correct focus.
Well, I don't think it's, you mean whether that was an element of the offense?
Well, your argument before that she did not distinguish the elements of offense, and I'm wondering whether that's relevant or not.
No, I think it's, what I'm saying is that courts have struggled for since Apprendi Booker with judicial fact finding, and I think that some of the unique elements about this case are, number one, the government's ability to structure the charge by choosing what statute to charge under, and number two, the fact that unlike maybe some other cases, the harm suffered to a victim inflicted by the defendant has traditionally in Anglo-American jurisprudence been considered an element of the offense that a jury has to determine. That's different than, let's say, even a drug case, where that doesn't have that type of analogous history. There are certain actions and certain elements that are given to the jury.
Not necessarily. Jury's verdict can find people guilty without finding specific acts. Your basic position in this case really rejects the jury verdict of guilty. The jury verdict of guilty finds that whatever injury was suffered by these people was a result of conduct of the parents. Now, exactly what conduct that was, the facts are in dispute somewhat, maybe, I don't know. But without your arguing in effect that you got if your argument were correct, you would then have a not guilty verdict. You wouldn't be standing here.
I don't agree at all. I'm sorry. We agree that the jury verdict that...
What did it resolve then? It didn't find guilty of the conduct resulting in this injury to the kids?
It resolved, for example, that the defendants used excessive corporal punishment at inappropriate times. So if a child spilled something at the table, for example, and a kid would get smacked for that, then the jury determined that that crossed the line and they're guilty of child endangerment. But
there's no endangerment unless the kid gets injured from that smack. You can hit a kid, and if there's no injury, there's no consequence to the alleged improper. Here, the jury found...
Under the Jersey statute, the way they define neglect, it doesn't require an injury to get...
That's right. The jury didn't have to find an injury.
But they found neglect. They found neglect.
They did.
And they've got to find an injury was as a result of that neglect. You deserve that.
No. Neglect and cruelty are two different elements, two different paths to a guilty verdict. Neglect charges, and the defendants were found not guilty of a neglect charge. The charge where the child spilled something, I don't think it's hypothetical, I think it's in the record, child spilled something and the parent employs corporal punishment at a totally... in a totally unreasonable time, in a totally unreasonable way. There's no injury to the child, but under the statute, that makes the child one who cruelty was applied to or done to, or however you want to phrase it. That's an act of cruelty, to use corporal punishment at an unreasonable time in an unreasonable manner.
Even though there was no injury.
Correct. That's how the jury was charged. We don't agree, but that's how the jury was charged. So that's why it's so ambiguous as to what they found.
What exactly happened with the pre-sentence report? Was it just that the government supplied a prosecution memo and the statement of facts in the PSR was basically taken from the prosecution memo? Or is it your contention anyhow, Mr. Romano apparently doesn't agree, the government actually wrote that, and I guess it depends on how you define wrote, well, drafted the pre-sentence report insofar as the facts are concerned?
When we got the pre-sentence report and saw the factual recitation, we knew that that couldn't have been done by an independent neutral source. We inquired. We found out, and the government conceded, that they wrote that portion of the
report. What do you mean by wrote
that? Sent them a memo stating their factual contentions.
Prosecution memo.
Did you have
a similar opportunity?
We had a similar opportunity.
Yeah.
We were curious, let's say, as to how much they incorporated it verbatim. And we asked both the probation department and the government to give us a copy of their memo so we could see whether they're copying it word for word. I'm not sure if we subpoenaed it once. I know we had discussions. We wanted to make that comparison. The government said that they wrote that type of narrative. They say it's standard. Judge Hayden was unhappy with that. And she said, I think absolutely correctly, this isn't a factual narrative of what happened. This is your contentions about what happened. This is argument. And she asked, it was Mr. Romano, I think, why did you do, you know, what's the purpose of this? And they said, and this is my brief, they said, well, if this case goes to the Court of Appeals, they're going to want to know the factual basis of what this case is all about. And so we supplied this to them so that they had that factual basis, which to me compounds the error. Judge Hayden said this was not done properly. We had a briefing about the way the probation manual sets out what they're supposed to do, et cetera, and this was totally improper. She struck it.
I'm still not sure what you mean by the verb wrote, that the prosecution wrote.
They sent a written submission.
A prosecution memo.
Prosecution memo.
That's how they found out about the case.
To the probation department, which without any independent analysis at all, as far as we know,
is just copying into the PSR.
Yes.
Okay.
And then that's why she struck it, because it wasn't done on any independent basis. It was an advocacy piece.
You're saying that where there was countervailing testimony, for example, what happened with the bioblock injury, that should have been in the PSR, or at least the judge should have been alerted to the fact that this is contested, but the judge sat through the trial and knew that was contested.
I'm sorry?
The judge sat through the trial and knew that was contested.
Sure. But we also were concerned it was going to go with our client to prison. It was going to come up to this court. We submitted a very long objection to the PSR, besides on the legal basis that they should do their own analysis of competing narrative of what happened.
A probation officer gets both positions or positions for one. They can adopt it or not adopt it. This is routine. I mean, I've seen it dozens of times myself.
Well, the manual for the probation department says they're supposed to make an independent investigation.
Yeah, they're supposed to make, but very often an independent investigation, they'll adopt the defendant or the prosecution's position totally. I've seen this. I say it's no secret.
They could, but at least there's some thought into it. Here, I don't think there was any. I can appreciate it. It was a long trial. You know, how are they going to go through the record? But the government, I think, overdid it by putting in a lot of their arguments and their contentions, which really weren't based on the record, and it's what they hoped a fact finder would find.
You said that in the initial discussion over the charge, where you wanted the jury to make specific findings as to the injury, and they opposed that, and they wanted to do it in the bifurcated process that you talked about.
Yes.
Okay. But in criminal cases, routinely, a verdict of guilty can be rendered, and the sentencing judge has to find the facts which go to the appropriate guideline, and whether the facts further justify a variance or whatever is appropriate for the sentencing. That's done routinely.
Certainly.
What is wrong with the procedure here, then?
Well, the procedure here was that the government structured the case so that certain crucial facts, which are normally elements of the offense,
injuries, causation.
Well, yeah, causation and extent of injury, away from the jury, and the government then wanted the judge to find those facts on a lesser burden of proof. And we contend that that can't be done without violating the Sixth Amendment.
Okay. The Booker.
Well, it goes back to that and more recent cases. We feel that's crucial fact finding. When we started the case, that's what the whole case was about. No question that these defendants hit these kids, but we contended that they didn't cause all these serious injuries, and the government claims that they did. And we were here years later, and that question's never been resolved. At least, and we feel it's inappropriate after 1.5 jury trials to have a judge decide that.
You don't think the jury decided causation in this case?
They didn't. And Judge Hayden said they didn't. She said, I don't know what the jury found. And
the judge could have, on her own, submitted special interrogatories and asked the jury to establish causation.
Sure.
If you find there are injuries here, tell us whether or not you conclude that the injuries were caused by the conduct. If you find the defendants engaged in the conduct, and go further and tell us whether or not any injuries that you find were...
Absolutely. And we wanted that to happen because we felt that the jury charge was wrong. If the jury had come back and said, yes, we find them guilty, but no, we don't find substantial injury, we would have been up here arguing...
Right. Well, their contention is, but that's not an element, and the jury shouldn't be required to find it.
Then this court would have had to decide that issue.
Well, look, the government wants to try one way, you want to try it the other. Both you and the government are entitled to a fair trial, but not a perfect trial.
Absolutely.
And you, no one got what they wanted, but the question is whether or not you got enough. I will solve that, I take it, in chambers.
Well, we didn't appeal the jury verdict. We said we'll go forward, and the government, took us here on the sentencing issue. We feel that the sentence, if I could just, I don't know, overstep my time, but...
Well, that happened about an hour and a half ago.
Judge Hayden was the only one in the courtroom who had extensive experience, both in her private practice and on the bench, dealing with family court issues and with abuse cases such as this. She had sentenced defendants in New Jersey courts under Title II.
We all know Judge Hayden.
Pardon me?
We all know Judge Hayden well.
And she imposed a sentence which very closely mirrors the amount of time that Carolyn Jackson would have spent had this case been tried in New Jersey State Court. That's what she should have done, and that's what she did. And at the end of the day...
Did she say anywhere in the record that that was the purpose of the sentence?
Is that anywhere in the record, right?
As opposed to 3553A factors.
I think that she said that was what... She talked about how she would handle this case if she were in a superior court.
Okay.
Where she said she would give these defendants, I think she said 7 years, with it. That actually translates to less than 24 months that she got. We think that was the appropriate...
Okay, we're going to hear from Ms. Markell. Okay.
Thank you, Yars.
May it please the court. My name is Louise Arkell. I'm an attorney with the Federal Public Defender's Office, and we represent.
Pull it down a little bit.
Pull it down.
Okay.
We represent appellee John Jackson. If I could turn to the analogous guideline question, it's an extremely straightforward analysis, and if I could give two examples, I think I can show why the government's approach of within the ballpark is not the appropriate approach. Assume for a second that endangering is a federal statute, and assume that the Sentencing Commission assigned the assault guideline to it. Courts would have to apply the assault guideline. That was part of Amendment 591. The government, however, concedes that the assault guideline was inappropriate for all the counts of omission. That illustration, I hope, and I'll pause for a second.
For the counts of omission?
Sorry, for the counts of omission. The counts of omission.
We don't have to agree with that, do we? If the government, is that the government's position?
I think as an analytical thing, it makes sense.
We don't have to agree with the government if that's the government's position.
You don't have to agree with the government's position, but I think it makes sense because...
Well, you're putting it in a hypothetical, aren't you?
It's a hypothetical.
So how about the commission?
The commission, the government argued that the guideline applied. But my point with the hypothetical is that it goes to show that the guideline should apply to the... You look first. The first determination of whether a guideline applies, you look to the elements. That's what makes sense. It's consistent with the structure of the guidelines. It is totally consistent with how Amendment 591 tried to clarify the application and that initial determination. It's not as if you don't ever consider actual conduct. You know, you can consider actual... Let's say a guideline does not apply. You can consider actual conduct within 3553. But the distinction I think the government was making with its crimes of omission, crimes of commission, is that you're looking at the means. There's a difference between looking at the elements and looking at the means. First step, you look at the elements. And that's why I think that hypothetical, it would violate the very application of the guidelines if the crimes of omission, and I think it's clear that failing to do something, and omission is a way of committing cruelty as well as neglect. To apply the assault guideline. I don't think the commission, would apply, would assign the assault guideline to an endangering statute structured as the New Jersey one is, because so many ways of committing the offense do not rise to the level of assault.
Saying like failure to provide a coat during the wintertime, that would violate the statute.
I'm sorry?
For example, you say failure to provide a coat during wintertime.
Right. That would not
violate
assault.
The statute.
Yet, under the guideline application instructions, the court would have to apply the assault guideline to all of those counts.
You say you have to look at the elements first?
Yes.
Yeah, but I always think of the elements as the facts that increase the maximum statutory offense. I don't look at the elements as necessary in this case as opposed to find the facts to determine or look at the facts to determine which guideline should be applied.
But it is. It is. The application instructions do provide that you look at the elements.
Elements are things that have to be found by a jury. Isn't that correct?
Correct.
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
I'm sorry. And I'm not making a Sixth Amendment argument. This is purely do you get into the guidelines. The governments, many of the government's cases compare, it. They involve where there are multiple guidelines. And I think that is a somewhat trickier trickier inquiry. We are looking at whether you ever get into the guidelines. Assault is not an element of the endangering statute. The jury was not instructed about assault. I am not saying that some of the conduct prohibited by the statute does not rise to assault, but the elements.
So what value does element have? If the state statute, it's very broad. It could be just leaving a child unattended, and it could be serious aggravated assault. Why then don't we focus on the facts rather than elements?
Well, I think that's a decision that the commission made in structuring the entire guidelines, that there is some value in considering what the elements of an offense are in assigning guidelines. First, you look at they call it the charge offense conduct. Then you look at the real offense conduct or the actual conduct. That is how the guideline. I said I had two examples because the other way of thinking about it that I think helps show why the government's approach doesn't work is what if the commission were to assign, to design, I should say, a guideline for the endangering statute? This is how I think it would work. It would assign a base level to the endangering statute designed to cover, you know, sort of a mean or a median, I don't know, an average of what might cover the conduct in the statute. Then it would apply design specific offense characteristics. So for inflicting unnecessarily severe corporal punishment, you might get a point, you know, plus two, plus four. For not providing a coat in the winter, you might get a minus two, a minus four. That's how the guidelines work. Here, you do not get into the guidelines because assault is not an element. Furthermore, I would also say it's a perfectly...
What if an assault is not an element, but an assault occurred?
If an assault occurred, you can, under the guidelines, you mean under my hypothetical?
Yes.
You would get under the endangering, assuming the guidelines provide an offense level, assuming the guidelines assign a guideline to an endangering statute. You get into the guidelines, you have your offense level, and the guidelines say, under specific offense characteristics, if an assault occurred, if the crime was committed by inflicting overly severe corporal punishment or anything else under the statute that would rise to the level of assault, apply, you enhance the base offense level. It happens all the time under the guidelines. That's how the guidelines work. So you wouldn't be unable to consider it. You would just, it's a question of getting into the guidelines. Here, there are so many ways of committing the offense element of cruelty and or neglect that I don't think the commission would assign a guideline to that. And if they did, they would deal with the means of committing the offense by way of specific offense characteristics.
If you engage in neglect of a child without assaulting the child, you engage in neglect, but you reasonably should know as a result of that neglect, the child is going to suffer injuries, why is that sufficiently analogous to the assault statute of the assault guideline?
Because I think assault has a meaning. And because the guideline instructions tell you if the element, you look at the elements, and if it doesn't meet the elements, it's not an analogous guideline.
Well, it doesn't have to be exactly analogous. As I mentioned, we applied the manslaughter guideline as assault to a case where manslaughter requires that someone get killed, and we said that's sufficiently analogous. To me, it's a fait accompli. If you neglect the kid is going to have some sort of physical injury. And if you reasonably should know that, you've assaulted the kid. You've only neglected the kid, you say, but in reality, you've assaulted the kid. What's wrong with that thinking?
I think Allard, which I assume you're referring to, is a perfect example of why of the power and the clarity that Amendment 591 provided. Allard predated Amendment 591. Okay. 591 says actual conduct should be taken into account at step two. Step one, do not look at actual conduct. So, and that would be a matter of fact finding. Specific offense characteristics are a matter of fact finding. If you get into the guidelines somehow by way of, or in that case, my argument would be you don't get into the guidelines.
But
if you do get into the guidelines, specific offense characteristics is where you take that into account. I'd also like to point out that I think Allard and a lot of other cases, I think an important piece of this argument or this case is that a lot of these cases predate Booker. And I'm not talking about Booker in the sense of the Sixth Amendment argument. I think the fact is that a lot of these cases occurred before 3553 was an integral component of the sentencing system. And I think it's 12 years after Booker, maybe it's hard to remember just how invisible, in a way, 3553 was. Now, we all speak fluent 3553. It is a fully developed, fully structured body statutory provision that takes into account all the purposes of sentencing. It is no longer, the most important thing is that is what the guidelines tell courts to do when there is not an analogous guideline.
Even under 3553, the sentence was unreasonable. And at that point, I assume he's arguing that once you get into 3553, in order to apply it, the judge at sentencing has to make a determination based upon a preponderance of the evidence of what happened. Was a causal relationship between the injuries and the neglect or conduct?
And I think this judge did. I think this judge, as you pointed out, this was a 10.5-hour sentencing hearing. This was a judge who had lived with this case for 2.5 years, heard, I believe, if I counted correctly, 45 witnesses, who held and at the end and heard and observed and reviewed thousands of documents, including expert reports, heard experts. She made the determination. It's not that she didn't make a finding. She determined that the causation was not established sufficiently to make those injuries the driving force of the sentence. It's not that she ignored them. She found that the government hadn't made the case for causation sufficiently to weigh those factors and make it anywhere near.
You said they were established by preponderance of the evidence. That's what you're saying.
I'm sorry?
You said that to her mind they were not the causal nexus wasn't established by preponderance of the evidence.
Yes. And I don't read the government's brief or argument to be complaining about specific findings of fact. Also, what I haven't heard is that what the judge did was essentially reject the government's characterization of this case. The government tried an endangering case. The government came into sentencing and talked about torture. She clearly rejected the idea of that this was a systematic campaign of torture. And was there evidence in the record to support that? Absolutely. She said the live doctors who saw these children at the time, the neighbors, friends, family who saw this family at the time, they didn't find what the government is characterizing, which was an unrelenting, systematic campaign of torture. Furthermore, absolutely central to her imposition of sentence, especially on John, was his military record, which the government treated quite dismissively at times. She noted a 22-year career of military service and service to this country. She took that.
Where does that get you, though? That could cut both ways.
And she recognized that. I'm glad you bring that up, because she looked at him and she said, you failed to protect your family. She saw that. She said, that adds to your culpability. She considered his culpability. That was a withering assessment of a man's failure to protect his family. She took that into account. But she also took
into account that goes beyond failure to protect.
And she acknowledged that.
It's danger to injure, almost wreaked havoc on.
She acknowledged his culpability as reflected in the verdict. She was quite clear that she accepted the verdict. She summarized it at points, and we cite that in our brief. I'd also like to say that
was there not a direct witness to the assaults, a child?
JJ.
Who testified at the sentence and asked for the maximum sentence because of
the biological
scandal. What he had seen.
He did. He did testify, and she took that into account. She credited some of his testimony, and she didn't credit some of his testimony. She credited, for example, that JJ had asked John to speak to Carolyn and try to help her, you know, be more gentle. That was part and parcel of her, you know, assessment of him as failing to protect. And she said, you'll have to live with that. On the other hand, she did not credit all of his testimony. She also considered a sort of central pillar of her sentence on John was all he had lost. She took into account the fact that this was a man who lost his career. His career was essentially erased. It's not as if you just can't practice your job anymore. His career was erased by the other than honorable discharge. He lost his pension. He lost his veterans benefits. He lost the ability to speak, to point to pride with his military career. Judge Hayden could not have been more thorough in her consideration of the sentencing factors. And in the end, her reasons for imposing the sentence were logical and consistent with the record. That is all that substantive reasonableness review requires, and I urge this court.
The problem with relying too much on that is something that's always bothered me, what the defendant lost. You basically have two systems of sentencing. The CEO comes in with a whole bunch of chips that he or she can put into the sentencing pot. Lost my job, lost my pension, lost my career, lost my position. I can't get into the country club anymore. Didn't nobody play golf with me. You got all these chips you can play. The poor slob from the corner who comes in because they work in the bodega 12 hours, they've got no chips to put in the sentencing pool. So you end up with a system where you've got chips to put in the pool, i.e. you're privileged in some way, you walk out the door. If you come in and you have no chips to put in the pool, you're not privileged, prison. That's my concern with that line of sentencing. And something that's bothered me historically when I was a sentencing judge, it bothered me. The argument making here bothers me. Under the guidelines, there's some provisions which I think are intended to mitigate that. They probably go too far in the other direction, but it's a real problem.
I have not really thought about that.
And it hurts 90% of your clients.
But many of our clients come into court with
chips.
They may not be chips, but they often are sort of deficits of chips. And we ask the courts regularly to take into account that people don't have a lot of support or don't have a lot to draw on. So I think maybe sometimes the deficit of chips is in and of itself a mitigating factor. And I think that's true for a lot of our clients. I think, as I said, Judge Hayden could not have been more thoughtful and comprehensive about the sentence. I urge this court to affirm. Thank you.
Mr. Meyer, you reserved, I think, 2 minutes for about to be true. You probably should get about a week and a half of it.
I'm going to attempt to be brief, Your Honor.
I hope so. We got more cases.
Let me start with the analogous guideline. What Ms. Arkell recognized is there are many ways to commit this offense. One of them is assaultive conduct. If the commission had selected guidelines for this offense, there is no doubt in my mind assault would be one of them. And so the question here is under 1B1.2A, under Boney, what do you look at? The charged conduct in the offense of conviction. The charged conduct in the offense of conviction here, which is plainly in the verdict sheet, is physically assaulting the kids on at least 3 of the counts. And again, we think 3 other of the accounts are figured too. Forcing toddlers to ingest painful substances. The assault guidelines are sufficiently analogous to those counts of conviction. They're within the ballpark. They should apply. That's the first thing.
You don't think Kaufman or Osborne undermine your argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because, again, even if you look at elements, even if you look at them, I think it could be a tool. Even if you do that, we're not looking for a match. We're looking for something with a ballpark.
That's your other argument.
The second thing I want to address is, and let me go back to this just for a second, assault. The defendants actually conceded below that the assault guidelines would apply. What I think happened is they realized the cross-reference would apply, and all of a sudden they didn't want the assault guidelines to apply anymore. Hmm. So if you look at pages 6083 to 84 of the appendix, 6083 to 84, and then 6438, and if you look at John's appendix, pages 8 and 11. So that's the first thing. Second, there's been a lot of talk about treating doctors. The judge relied on treating doctors. Everyone's talking about treating doctors. The treating doctors were lied to repeatedly. They were told, oh, the birth mother did this. They were told, oh, we just got custody back from the birth mother. That's why she looks like this. They were told the mother was crack addicted. They were told that, you know, the C had surgery on her lip. That's why part of it is missing. Those were all...
The mother was crack addicted. How would that help?
Because they claimed that the reason the child is not... Yes, right. The reason the child's not growing. You know, she had part of her lip surgically removed. The doctors believe this. You know why? Because they're educated. They look military. They're very, you know, they seem like they're very with it, but they care. Those were all lies. And the doctors all said on the stand, if I had known those were lies, then yes, I would have been very concerned about this. And in fact, even with the lies, the doctors said, I was very concerned about this. So this reliance on the treating physicians is completely ignoring whole swaths of evidence.
Yeah. And they just didn't see one treating physician. They saw one that didn't tell the other, that didn't tell the third.
And the only doctor, let's remember this, the only doctor that saw both Joshua and C was Dr. Gutierrez. And he said, oh, my God, this looks like abuse, and immediately called, you know, immediately got, you know, some tests, and then called the whistle, blew the whistle on this, and that's how it ended. So that's only one person at trial testified who saw both of those kids, and that's how this ended. And then the last point I want to make is Mr. Waldman said, and I think he conceded, I'm so glad, he conceded right up here. What the judge did was said, I'm going to be like a state sentencing judge, and I'm going to impose the sentence that would be served in the state. That is legal error. ACCA does not require that. Congress did not require that.
Require is not the word. Not what requires it is whether it allows that.
What I would say, Your Honor, is that maybe that ACCA doesn't allow it. What allows it is post-Booker sentencing. But what post-Booker sentencing says is you have to apply 3553A. You apply the guideline. If you want to consider what would happen in the state, and again, we don't think that's very important, you consider it as part of that entire analysis. Not what Mr. Waldman said, which is she was required to do that. That's what she did. That was essentially the sole factor here was what would a state court judge? A state court judge, she said, if I were a state court judge, I would give 5 years. And under parole, that means that it would be 24 months. Congress acted in 1990. It said under 3551, it applied, ACCA convictions are sentenced according to the federal sentencing guidelines, sentencing reform, not to impose the same punishment that would be imposed in state. If Congress wanted to say that, they could have. It didn't. So we think that that's another error that's going to be sent back to the judge to say, look, what you're supposed to be applying is federal sentencing policy. Now consider what happens in the state. Go ahead, but you're going to have to explain very thoroughly why you're rejecting congressional policy and the Sentencing Commission policy in order to do that. So does this court have any other questions? If not, I would ask that this sentence be vacated and remanded for resentencing.
No.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't need it.
Okay. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.